Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the New Books Network channel in sociology. I'm your host, Richard Osijo of the City University of New York. And I'm joined today by writer Malcolm Harris, who's the author of the book Kids These Days, Human Capital and the Making of Millennials. Malcolm, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great. So besides your birth year, which you have on the cover, confirming that you are a true millennial, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and the origins of this book and how you came to write it.
Well, let's see. I grew up, went to elementary school, middle school, high school in Palo Alto, California, which is a location of note these days, I guess, as it was at the time as well, writing about the economy. So I certainly had a certain insight growing up there. And then I went to school at the University of Maryland. And while I was there, while I was at the University of Maryland, the 2008 financial crisis hit. And so I was, you know, at a school full of 30,000 young people who suddenly didn't know what kind of world we were about to enter. And I was part of a political group on campus called Students for a Democratic Society that was fighting a campaign against a proposed tuition increase. And so me and a friend researched and did this teach-in about the financial crisis, linking the financial crisis to this campaign we were doing about tuition at our school. What's the connection between the housing crisis and university tuition? And that connection ends up being a lot closer, a lot tighter than I had imagined in the first place. And that turns into an article a few years later for N+1 about the student debt regime system, which hadn't been written much about at that time. And then that article sort of grows into this book as I realize and work through the questions of student debt, how central is this question of human capital, and in turn, how central that is to the economy itself.
Right, cool. And we're going to get into some of those topics, which you take up in the book a little bit later on. But just to start from the beginning, so this is the sociology channel. And in sociology, we use this concept we call the sociological imagination to help understand the world, basically meaning to put people's biographies and their personal journeys in their specific contexts. That is, the times and the places and the structures that are totally beyond their control. And I think you do a really great job of this in the introduction, where you really state the aim for the book, which is to really kind of cut through a lot of the popular stereotypes that we have of millennials, and to really try to reveal some of the conditions that these millennials, that millennials find themselves growing up and coming of age and becoming adults under. Can you tell us a little bit about some of those? Some of that context that we often miss out on, that often gets ignored?
Yeah, well, I like to think I'm in the same theoretical tradition as C. Wright Mills and as other conflict theorists within sociology, other Marxists within the Marxist tradition, because the context for the development of this generation and the context for all of society is this question of class conflict. And that is almost always left out of any account we have of generations. And if it is included, it's in this really crude metaphorical sense where some generation is supposed to stand in for the proletariat or something, which is silly. But by looking at the changes to class relations over the past 35 years, I think that's how we can get a sense of what it means to have a generation or to mark a generation.
Right. And as I was reading the introduction where you lay this overarching framework out, I kept going back to the title. So the idea of kids these days, and it's always like, oh, kids these days are so different. But I kept thinking, well, it could easily be entitled parents these days. Parents these mm-hmm. days are obviously also different, and they are really the ones who are behind these structures and these conditions that millennials find themselves growing up in.
That's true. Although there were cases, I guess, overall in the course of my research, I started to go sort of easier on parents. The more I researched and found out, the more I sort of softened toward individual parents, because they're responding to real social trends. Those are the parents that we think are causing the issues by being helicopter moms or whatever. This is mostly cases of parents responding to situations that are, like you said, way beyond their control and trying to make livable futures for their children, which is becoming more and more difficult. But it's true that that just because I'm looking at young people, that's a advantage point to look at the changes to society over this time period.
Right. Yeah. It's a great distinction, and also it's a great point, I think, to make. Yeah. So you, in the first chapter, you start from the beginning, I guess, right? You start with youth, you start with kids in school, and you have a great letter from an elementary school sent to parents. And this was, I think, in 2014. And it's telling these parents that they're canceling the school's annual play because basically they can't spare the time. They're too busy. They have standardized exams and they have to prepare for them and all this kind of stuff. And you use this to introduce the main theme of this chapter. And that's the idea that schoolwork has become just so intensified today. So how does this chapter really set the stage for what's going to be coming when we throughout the book?
The idea of human capital, I think, and that's, you know, it's in the title. It's a through line of the book for sure. And another way that I started approaching this book in the first place was thinking about human capital and schoolwork as building human capital, building the future skills necessary to run an economy, and yet not being recognized as labor. And the sociologist Jürgen Zinnecker, whose work I believe undertranslated, did a really good job of looking at what he calls the pedagogical mask, whereby we look at schooling activity and think of it as some sort of consumption as opposed to productive behavior. Economically productive behavior.
Right. And this human capital logic has become infused really within all of schoolwork, and it's impressed upon children, you say, from a real young age to really build up as much as possible. But the key here is that there's a limited payoff that they're going to be receiving from it.
In a really simple supply and demand sort of way, where you think if there are companies that are looking to hire skilled workers, there is a demand for skilled labor power. If you flood the market with cheap or with labor power, with skilled labor, with human capital, you're going to lower the price. And that's what we've seen happen as more and more people build more and more human capital on their own time, with their own effort. The price has gone down. We've seen wages stagnate even for people with degrees.
Right. And this really leads to this next topic. And it's in many ways kind of how you started in college debt. So we have tuition obviously going up considerably in both public and private colleges and universities, while wages have not, at least not proportional to the rise of tuition or in terms of keeping up with inflation. So we essentially have this generation that is indebted, but without the means to get out of that debt, which they're told from a very young age they have to enter into. So what are some of the realities that college students face today? Most are not the traditional 18 to 22, finish in 4 years, don't have to work, don't have to worry, can explore the liberal arts education and then become adults immediately. It's a lot more complicated than that. You show the landscape of college and the typical college student.
Yeah, the typical college student is something that we get a lot of pictures of that in the media about what a college student is. And that may have been more, it was definitely more accurate about past generations. What a college student looked like in the baby boomer generation is different than what a millennial college student looks like because it's a much broader percentage of the population. And so now you have a situation where 70% of college students work, do wage labor in addition to schoolwork. And it used to be about a quarter. And so that's a huge difference. And we haven't really incorporated that change into our idea of what a college student is. There are more college students who are food insecure, that is like literally hungry, than there are college students who live on campus. And right. that's nowhere near what we think in terms of the popular imagination about what a college student is. But we need to get it in our heads that these are poor workers.
Right, right. And a real, related to this, a real illuminating and I think a very important part of the book is when you really describe how student debt works, the realities of it, the history of it, and also why college costs so much. What are some of those, what is some of that history? What are some of those reasons?
Well, one thing, a very recent one that people don't necessarily know because it wasn't really in anyone's interest in the government to talk about it that much, is that the whole, almost the entirety of college financing was nationalized with the Affordable Care Act. So as part of that bill, as a cost-saving element of that bill, the federal government directly took over around 85% of student lending. But that hasn't actually slowed the rate of increase on the cost of college because people are still able to get that money, whether it's the government or private lenders. The difference is now it's the government is making profit instead of private lenders, which I guess is somewhat of an improvement, but not exactly what people were thinking and not exactly what people would think if you said the government nationalized student lending.
Right. I didn't know that. And I think a lot of readers aren't reading that very recent history, really. That's so intertwined with so many issues that we discuss regularly going on in the U.S. So moving on then, after college, this progression we have here through the life of a millennial, you discuss the world of work, so post-college, and you use Arne Kallenberg's famous breakdown of, sounds simple, but the idea of good and bad jobs based on a variety mm-hmm. of criteria. So very traditional criteria like pay and benefits, but also a job's flexibility, a job's the amount of autonomy a job grants a worker over their own work, a job's stability, all these different factors, a job's level of precariousness. So basically the idea that the economy has become more precarious, labor markets have become less stable. What are some of the implications for these shifts in the labor market, specifically for young adults, young workers like millennials?
Well, everything you just said is true, and a big part of that reality. We've seen temporary work increase of jobs where the connection between worker and employer is reduced, where the duties of an employer to an employee or someone they're paying might not even be an employee these days, probably not, have been reduced. And that includes pay. And so if you look at everything, and the Kallenberg book is awesome. It's a really great sort of meta-analysis of the trends within labor over the time period that I'm talking about. And what he sees can often be reduced to decreasing labor costs. And so whatever change is going to happen, the Occam's razor, easiest way to explain any change that's happened to the economy over the past 35, 40 years is decreasing labor costs. Every amount of precarity, every change in contract relationships, et cetera, every change they've made it's been about one thing, and that's been reducing labor costs. And they've been very successful. Now, what that means for the cohort of workers who are coming into the market as that's happening is they get paid worse. They work harder and they get paid worse. And it's so much of it is very uncomplicated.
Yeah. Meanwhile, this cohort of millennials, they've been essentially raised to keep up with these productivity demands of the new economy. It's almost as if their upbringing has really dovetailed with these larger economic shifts.
Yeah, it's quite a coincidence, right? and it's funny watching the national discourse get it sort of backwards to say that, you know, major macroeconomic shifts are about the personality of millennials rather than the other way around, as if our like demographic quirkiness has produced the 21st century economy as opposed to the 21st century economy producing our demographic quirkiness. And it really has been a blame the kids sort of situation. But I think that's starting to shift now, I hope.
Right, right. There's also the other side of the argument that, right, and relates to the whole, millennials have this sort of innate personality that they almost welcome this change. They want the flexibility, right? That they want the autonomy. They've internalized, you can say that they've internalized this human capital logic so much to such a great extent that they feel that there is no other alternative than to really see yourself as this totally individualized worker, a free agent, essentially, trying to gain as much as you can for yourself in this new economy.
And some of it gets like really, really silly when we got like the new food courts, for example. It's like, millennials can't afford, you know, the labor costs of a TGI Fridays. But you know what they're really like is, you know, consuming all their meals in mall style food courts. Congratulations. You can now eat all your meals in really hip mall style food courts or tiny houses. You know, why would you want a full-sized home when you can have a tiny house? Like, you millennials, you're so crazy, you want smaller living spaces. Well, of course, people don't want smaller living spaces. That's ridiculous. But these changes to the quality of life that people are allowed in this country has been written down as a kind of demographic characteristic, as if wanting less is how we came into the world.
Right. You're born in a certain time frame, some cosmic change occurred that implanted this idea in your head or something like that, right? So, yeah.
And people don't really think that. They understand that we are the products of the world into which we're born. But we have to ask questions about generational responsibility and cohorts and stuff. You know, we can't blame baby boomers forever. In 30 years, there's going to be no one else to blame. So the people shouldn't get that confused.
Right. And to build off of this, I think chapter 4, you discuss a topic that I don't think is discussed as often as it really should be. And it's really about the relationships that millennials have with a variety of federal programs and different areas of government. And I think this has been brought into stark relief most recently at the end of 2017 with the discussion of the tax bill and some of the future long-term implications that this could have, especially for older generations, but also for younger generations when it comes to Social Security, when it comes to Medicare. And you really go into some really interesting detail about about Social Security and about programs and policies that relate to youth poverty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, youth poverty is, again, something I think the public conception of is very inaccurate, especially as it relates to elder poverty. We have no problem imagining old people as poor. we sort of like think they should be because they don't work on some level in this country because of our certain ethics or whatever. But actually, the elderly are the least poor demographic. They have the smallest rate of poverty, and that's solely due to federal programs. And that's a good thing. Everyone thinks that's a good thing. Young people think that's a good thing. We're all very happy about it. But what people don't realize is that there's been this trend of the juvenilization of poverty. While we've solved elderly poverty, we've totally ignored youth poverty. And so this idea has become more common in the literature over the past decade or so, the juvenilization of poverty, that minors, children under 18, have a increasingly high rate of poverty in America, which is true. But one thing we don't talk about is that the young adult level, which is now about the same as the youth level. So it's not just that people are under 18 that makes them poor. It's about when they're born. It's about their place in this in these demographic trends. And so the rate for young workers is around 20% of poverty. Which is the same as it is for actual minors. So yeah, that's a distribution of poverty that is, I do not think is very well understood.
Yeah, this chapter really made me think of how we associate different social types with certain spaces, certain geographical locations. And I think a lot of the portrayals of millennials is often, say, the Silicon Valley young tech entrepreneur or something like that. When in fact, it's just as likely to be somebody from a poorer, say a more rural region, or from some struggling small town or something like that, where there is greater amounts of scarcity, where there's less of a social mobility ladder, and a lot more of these social ills and social problems that are afflicting younger generations.
Yeah, and that doesn't surprise any sociologists, I would imagine, who know about, bourgeois universality and the perspective on what a citizen is that we get from media that is controlled by a certain class. But it's worth understanding and emphasizing that is even less true of this generation than it has been in the past. So because of the way the job market has shifted over the past 30 years, and rising inequality and the shrinking ruling class, that means all of those bourgeois universal descriptors that we're so used to are even less true of this generation than it was in the past. So in terms of generational descriptors, those have been really misleading. And it's true that we hear them all the time. I can get a laugh anytime I say avocado. All I have to say is avocado, and people in the crowd are like, oh, ha, ha, ha. Yeah, millennials, avocados, expensive fruit, et cetera. But it is nothing to do with this question of young people who were born during this period at which relations between classes were changing so drastically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a cool chapter you have, chapter 5, where the first thing I thought was, oh, okay, this is the first chapter where, not all is gloomy with millennials. And you do show how, their technological innovations have allowed millennials to be, to be creative by making and distributing their own creative content to an extent that previous generations have not been able to do. And there is something to say for that, I think. And you give it its discussion. But but you also show, even these leisure activities like making music, like making videos, all the way up until the sports, youth sports, still require a lot of labor, a lot of really difficult work, and that there are these existing societal structures that are in place to try to exploit these efforts. So while there is this sunny side about creativity, about expression, about personal, innovation and so on, there's also the flip side to it, that these existing structures are nimble enough to figure out what these shifts are all about and to figure out ways to exploit this, essentially this youth labor, in many cases underage youth labor.
Yeah, one of the best examples and ones that I bring up in the book is, I think, the platform Vine, which a lot of us, I think, miss, the social media platform Vine. These little, like, I think it was 4-second loops of video and audio, and they're really popular, very cool. And it was young people who were totally propping up the platform, who were having a lot of fun making these videos that everyone else got to enjoy and got to enjoy the fun they were having. But that also was making money for people who were not these young people. And so when they went to the company, when they went to Vine and said, look, here's our offer. You know, we'll keep making this content. We'll make more of it. We'll make tons of these fun videos. But here's how you're going to cut us in. Here's how we're going to share in, you know, the profits of our creativity. And Vine just said no. And they just said no. This whole plan is based off not having to pay you. And the platform ended up shutting down. And I think now platforms are probably a little, they're definitely more interested in cultivating individual performers, individual young people, as it becomes more obvious that those individuals can be worth a lot of money and it can be worth it to cultivate them. But that means anyone who's trying to create, anyone out there who's just trying to make whatever or who's trying to succeed or no matter what, they're part of this giant talent search now that is the biggest game in media. Automatically, they are turned into work. Their play is turned into work by the nature of the platform because someone's cashing in. And there are pluses and minuses to that. But taken in the context of the full set of changes that we've observed, it's not a great time to have been born.
You have a great line about Vine that they would they'd rather die than share some of their profits with the content producers, which I think is a really fascinating description and reality of a lot of these platforms. And obviously it's not just Vine and it's not just millennials, but all they are the ones who are tagged with the tech label. So, you know, Twitter, obviously Facebook, any other number of these platforms where it's, you know, user generated content, I think would be applicable to what you're saying, but also the NCAA as the example from, mm-hmm. you know, the sports world, which has NCAA has been around for a long time. I'm not sure exactly how long, but they obviously predate millennials. But there has definitely been, I think, in terms of not just the sheer size and scale and the amount of money that's poured into college sports, which is supposed to be amateurs, but in terms of how they're actually structured to reach down to the youngest levels of competition to create some sort of pipeline of sorts from youth up until young adulthood.
Yeah, and basketball, especially searching the whole world, because it's the same thing we see in entertainment. Is rarely in this economy is one individual person worth so much as in sports and entertainment, and so we get to see things play out on a different scale. But so teams will go searching the whole world, go to places where people don't even play the sport they're trying to recruit for. Just on the odds game that out of a billion people, let's say in India, out of a billion people, you will find one professional basketball player. Even if those are your odds, even if your odds are one in a billion, you can do it. You can go find them. And that has to do with changes in data technology and our ability to comb the world in globalization. But all of that has changed the level of competition so totally. So that if you put, whether it's basketball or football or whatever, put a player from 40 years ago up against, you know, stand them in the same room with a player from now, and they look completely different. You're talking about different kinds of people. Mm-hmm. If you're 6 inches and 50 pounds heavier, that's a totally different game. And in football, we've gotten to the point where football is no longer compatible. The game itself is no longer compatible with the level of competition. People are just too big that they can't play anymore because they break each other's heads open.
Yeah.
That's sort of a metaphor for the economy in this situation where we've built people so detailed to their requirements, to the requirements for what we need from them, or what we think we will need from them, or what employers want from them, that the system doesn't even work anymore.
Yeah, I think it's an unlikely metaphor for, like you said, for what's happening overall to millennials. I think sports, though, really captures it, you know, quite well. Now, you have at the start of chapter six, you have a cite a few studies that the findings of which are really interesting. So behaviorally, you talk about how millennials as a group really show an overwhelming lack of trust in other people. And just given how individualized society and how individualized the economy have become and how much risk people are asked to personally absorb, and just given the era that millennials have been coming of age, I guess this finding is also not very surprising.
Yeah. The psychological effects of all these changes are hard to measure, I think, in some ways. I'm skeptical of self-reported data in that way because I think the language we use to talk about these things changes so much. But especially with social trust, the numbers are just so drastic that there simply has to be something. There must be something real under that data. And I think it's to be expected. If we look at the changes that constitute the millennial cohort, you should trust people less. It's smart to trust people less. In a situation where people are more competitive, then less trust is a useful adaptation. And so we've created a world in which, I mean, it's over 90% of people don't think most people are trustworthy. Now, they're probably right. Right? If 90% of people are telling you something about the society they live in, they probably have a pretty good sense of it. They're probably not coming from nowhere. And so we have to ask, you know, why have we created a world in which we can't trust other people, in which it's not smart to trust other people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And related to, obviously, there's the mental health, the mental health consequences and the topic of medication that goes on. But I think, you know, part of their behavioral differences that is really something that is probably among the most discussed is the big role of social media and technology and the internet and so on in the lives of millennials. But what I think is really enlightening about this chapter is how there's a real caution to not see social media use as a cause of millennials' issues, but more to see it as a symptom of some sort of larger problem that afflicts this generation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I differ with, I think Jean Twenge is probably and I use her research in that chapter about comparative mental health for generational cohorts. But she's come out really, really strongly, and I read her book, iGen, or Advertisement, whatever it is, about what's supposed to be the next generation after millennials. And I figured it would be more nuanced than the Atlantic article about, there was an excerpt about how, you know, it's these iPhones. But no, that's really what she thinks. She thinks the introduction of the iPhone is a major social turning point. And the research that I've done doesn't back that up. There are long macroeconomic changes, trends that are producing these shifts in the responses that she's seeing. And she has in her research not taken economic causes seriously at all, really, not even a little bit. Just straight up looks at the unemployment rate, the official unemployment rate, and says, therefore, people can't be depressed because the unemployment rate is under 5. Which I think is poor thought.
To move on then to the conclusion, I like the title who you have here. So the idea of, you know, 7 signs of the bad future. What are some of these long-term trends that you see continuing based on what's going on with the millennial generation now as they start to enter into, I guess now it's going to be in their mid to late 30s. They're starting to enter into prime adulthood.
Yeah, and so these were all things that I think are already happening in some way or another, but these are things, like specific things, where I think we're going to see qualitative jumps in the next decade or so. Things like climate, which since I've written this, has basically come true, which is that it will be a central focus of our social organization, will be zones of climate intensity, for example, and we're going to have to like live around that. That's going to determine the domestic movement of populations, probably the international movement of populations as well, more than anything else. And that's new. Discrimination by algorithm, I think, is a huge one. We've given a lot of power over to black box algorithms, and we don't know how those are relating to our anti-discrimination laws, which was a historically important part of American liberalism. And we don't know if they're just being completely obviated by Facebook. Well, I mean, we know that they are in some way, in some cases, where you've got housing ads that are being targeted by racial demographics. That's a big shift. That's a shift in the kind of society we're headed towards. And I think that's going to happen more and more. I'm trying to think what else I have got in my list. I think as we have more folks suffer with mental health issues, we're going to have to find some other solution than prisons for holding everyone. And I don't know if that's going to be in a return to asylums or what exactly that's going to be, but I don't think it's going to be a good thing. So basic worker protections, I think, will be eroded along with that. It's going to get really ugly really fast, is basically what that section says. And since I wrote it, I've been surprised at how fast all of it's happening.
And it also, to me, the book overall, to me, the book really begs the question of what of Generation Z, which I don't think has a name yet, but millennials were at one point called Generation Y, and then someone came up with millennial and the marketing stuck. What of the generation that's going to inherit a lot of the ongoing conditions that you've seen even since your book's publication? Some of these forecasts start to come true that are going to really inherit these this situation that millennials have been dealing with for their entire lives. I don't know. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's too soon to tell. And I think when people are projecting now what they think the changes are, they're still talking about the same shift that I'm talking about. And they're not talking about the next one, I don't think. Because I think the conflicts that are going to end up characterizing millennials have not fleshed out yet. I think liberal capitalist democracy is headed for a real series of trials, and that's what's going to define our cohort. So Generation Z or whatever, iGen, no one should use iGen. I hate that I have to say that every time I want to talk about Jean Twenge's work, is I've got to use this brand name that she came up with. But whatever that cohort is going to be in relation to events that have not occurred yet. At least that's my understanding of the historical moment. So I think we've still got our hands full. Marketers especially, are eager to move on whenever they see a new consumer demographic. So that's what matters to them in terms of marketing a new demographic or new generation, is now they can say, okay, now a new generation can buy stuff. So we need to understand that because we want to sell them stuff. That's not as interesting to me as the like broader historical turning.
Right, right. I mean, just like, yeah, there'll always be another generation down the line, I guess, for folks to sell them their things to, their their stuff, their services, and their ideas.
Until there's a last one. But when that generation is coming up, people are still going to name it and try and sell it stuff. So, mm-hmm. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. I'm curious to hear what the reaction to your book has been in terms of generation. Have you noticed any kind of differences in terms of how millennials versus Gen X versus baby boomers have received your book and some of its arguments?
Yeah, there have been some distinctions. Millennials, tend to get it and how it applies to them, which is unsurprising because it is focused on their cohort experience. A lot of baby boomers also see their experience and their experience with children. There's a little bit of a hole I've found with Generation X readers, where that's where my biggest complaints have, I think, gotten out. I've been from Generation X folks, and I sort of want to tell them that not every generation confronts history in the same way, and like not every generation matters the same amount. And like, I'm sorry that Generation X is like not super historically important in my reading. But I think they may have realized that from the writing itself and are not particularly enthused.
Yeah, it's interesting to see some arguments play out, arguments in the book play out in real life when it comes to different generational differences and generational conflicts. I feel bad for the Gen Xers. I'm a cusp person myself. So I see both sides of it quite interestingly mapped onto my life. So anyway,
like I said, it's not like anyone's any generation. Generations are not metaphors for classes in conflict. People should take heart. It's not like if you're in the wrong generation, you're on the wrong side or whatever. It's about how you relate to these changes that have happened in society. So nothing personal, Gen X folks.
Cool, man. Cool. So we've taken up a lot of your time already. So I'll ask one last question. So what have you been working on now? Is it any kind of follow-up to this book, or is it something besides a book? Tell us what you're working on.
It's hard because when you do work on generations in particular, there's a big market for that. And so there's a lot of people get stuck once you've entered the world of generational analysis. It's easy to never leave because there are people who want you to consult. There are lots of, college, whatever. You can always write more books about the same stuff and people will still buy them. And so that's what happens basically to anyone who takes up this work. So I'm trying not to do that. I will be moving on to different topics in the near future, I hope. Although hopefully still talking about this with people as it interests them. I've done a lot of work and thought about it a lot and don't want to throw it away. But you could really, the descent into hackery with generational analysis can come really fast. And so I try to be aware and cautious about that.
Well, Malcolm, thank you so much. It's a great book. I think it's an important book, a really keen synthesis, and also just a very deep reflection of a lot of stereotypes and misconceptions that we have of millennials, while forwarding a really insightful argument. So thank you for talking about the book a little bit on the show.
Thank you so much. And I love the podcast. It's been an honor to be on.
All right. Take care. Bye.